From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, Barack Obama will give one of the most important speeches of his presidency. As Sunni militants threaten the Middle East, he will lay out his plan for how the United States will respond. Americans know speeches like this one and have seen their implications in Vietnam, Cambodia, Central America, the Balkans, Iraq, more. Longtime foreign correspondent H.D.S. Greenway reported on all those and more. Nearly 50 years covering the world and America's changing status in it. He's with us this hour on Point. H.D.S. Greenway on a life in the news and America's role in the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on America's global standing and role as the president prepares another call to arms tonight? And what about the way we learn about the world now, our foreign reports? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is H.D.S. Greenway, longtime news correspondent. He was at the White House the day President Kennedy was shot, reported deeply on the Vietnam War for Time magazine and the Washington Post. He saw civil war in Lebanon, genocide in the Balkans, covered American intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan as an editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. And I should say he was a key mentor and boss to me early in my career. His new memoir, which opens the books on his reporting abroad and what he saw, is titled Foreign Correspondent, H.D.S. Greenway. David, welcome to On Point. Welcome back, I should say.
Good morning.
It's wonderful to have you here. And I should start right off with a thanks, because when I was a wee lad, 20-something, hired at the Globe, Boston Globe, and seemed like 2 minutes later you had me headed out as a Tokyo bureau chief covering all of Asia. That was an enormous event in any journalist's life. It was an enormous event in mine. All these years later, you're writing your memoir, and I thank you for that. A lifelong gift or flip of the switch, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, you made the Globe look good.
I'll take that and be glad for it. I could not have imagined, I don't think in those years, and I wonder what you make of the horror we've seen in just these last few weeks, of not one but two American journalists, foreign correspondents, freelancers, as so often is the case today, beheaded in apparently the deserts of Syria. What were you thinking?
Well, it's always been a dangerous profession. As you know, Tom, if you were caught by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in the old days, they killed everyone. No reporter ever came back from being captured.
Including friends of yours who
vanished
in that realm.
We're never seen again. But the disgusting thing is to cut their heads off on camera. And that's done for political purposes. And not the least of which is to provoke the United States into an overreaction. And, you know, reporters, we take our chances. We know what we're getting into. And we shouldn't drive foreign policy. So I hope that the terrible fate of those two reporters isn't going to influence American foreign policy.
And yet, it's pretty widely understood that no small part of the reason the president is making this speech tonight is exactly because of the impact of those videotaped and globally reported beheadings of reporters.
Absolutely, but terrorists always try to get big powers to overreact. They'd love to be the defender of the faith against the United States. So I'm sure the president is keeping that in mind. At least I hope he is.
David, the world was never a rose garden. Eden is a long time ago. And yet, in the span of your career, America's place in the world and the experience of Americans in the world has changed a lot. I was thinking as I read through these pages of this elegantly written and insightful memoir that many young Americans today just may not have any sense of what it was. Take when you were a young man, going abroad in the UK, your first interactions with the Time magazine empire, the Luce, Henry Luce family and empire, the experience of being an American in an American institution like that abroad in the 1960s. Almost unimaginable, I think, to young Americans today. But give us a sense of it.
Well, that's right. But of course, in those days, it wasn't that long after World War II. and the world was prostrate and we were the last man standing. So Americans, you could live in Paris for almost nothing. The exchange rate was wonderful. Americans were kings in those days. So I'm not one who really backs the thesis of the decline of America, but other powers have risen, and that was inevitable. So it's a little different too. But as you say, the loose empire then had a whole building on the corner of Bruton and New Bond Street in London. Henry Moore's on the roof.
Fabulous sculpture. Henry Luce himself, I think, admonished you for coming to your meeting with him by second class.
Yes, he said.
First class, his correspondent should travel.
That's right. And that didn't last very long.
Yeah. And yet there was that spirit. I remember Time magazine, even a couple of decades later in Tokyo, when I first arrived there, having been sent by you, their bureau chief was driven around the city in a chauffeur-driven limousine, which had American flags fluttering on the fenders, MacArthur style, in the 1980s.
And Henry Luce told me that the Time bureau chief in London is the second most important American after the ambassador. So there's a little bit of hubris there. But yes, American correspondents were making more money. They could travel around more easily. And the freelancer today doesn't have an organization behind him. I mean, just 9 years ago, when I landed in Baghdad, the New York Times Company sent an armored Mercedes to the airport, bulletproof glass as thick as your thumb, Iraqis with machine guns to guard me.
To pick you up and get you to a hotel.
Yes. And
a bunkered hotel.
And the chase car behind me, meaning a car was following me with armed Iraqis. In case my car was stopped, the backup car would
get in there.
That's right.
Institutional backup.
Yes. And that has almost vanished today.
Meaning people are on their own, they're more vulnerable,
they're less
supported in the field.
Yes, and there's no backup. And so that can be, you know, detrimental to the gathering of the news.
But and to one's health.
Well, definitely to one's health.
I'm trying to think of who goes out to gather the news today and who went out then. Maybe you were always an exception. You came from a very kind of high-placed family, I forget how many greats, grandfather, you name it, a president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, another business colleague of Andrew Carnegie. What drew you from that station in life to go out and get into the swamps of Vietnam?
I think Harrison Salisbury, the great New York Times reporter, once said that journalism is an excuse for shy people to ask questions. And I thought, what could be more fun than to go around gathering stories and being actually paid for it? So if you like telling stories, it's a very good business to be in.
You were in the Navy before you went into the journalism. Time magazine right out of the gate. These were lush days. How did you end up in Vietnam?
Well, I asked to go. It seemed to me that this was going to be the defining moment of my generation, and it was, how could I miss the story?
1967, I think you're right,
yes,
in Vietnam.
Yes.
What was the state of the war at that point?
Well, we had gone from sending advisors to sending ground troops 2 years before in 65. And it was when I arrived, everyone in the headquarters, military and diplomatic, told me we were winning the war. Yet when I got out on the field, I saw it was a slightly different story, that we weren't winning the war. And I also learned, I had thought coming out there, well, this is necessary to prevent communism, and it's a just war. And then I began to see that we were stepping into a culture and a civil war that we didn't know much about and we didn't understand. And I was so interested to have Robert McNamara, Kennedy's and Johnson's Secretary of Defense, a key architect of the war. And when after the war was over, he had a conversion and said that he'd never known anything about Vietnamese culture and history and that the war had been a terrible mistake. Well, I wish he'd I wish he'd come to that conclusion a little earlier.
Though you're disarmingly frank, I guess of necessity, about the blind spots of everyone around the world, including yourself. Your number one assistant and best friend in Vietnam himself was a spy for the North, until years later.
That's right.
Humbling.
Yes, very humbling. I went back after the war and asked him, and we had been pretty good pals. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, was your job to deceive Time magazine and plant false stories on us and twist the news and in Hanoi's favor? And he said, no, my bosses said, don't fool around with that at all. You might get fired. What we want you to do is assess South Vietnamese units, find out which commander, battalion commander can be bribed, which one might secretly be on our side.
Using his journalistic cover to do this, under your wing.
Under our wing, exactly. And that was his main job.
You've got more stories in here across many continents, many conflicts in Bangladesh. We'll talk about that. You spotted the Indian guns, but not the Indian soldiers.
That's right.
We'll come back to that. H.G.S. Greenway is with us. His new memoir, both personal and really political, goes, if President Obama's thinking strategy, maybe this should be on his nightstand. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with longtime global news reporter H.D.S. Greenway about a life in the news and America's role and standing in the world behind us. Huey helicopters in Vietnam, the kind of iconic sound of the Vietnam War. David Greenway was deep in that war and many other conflicts around the globe over nearly 50 years. As American reporters are beheaded in the desert and an American president prepares to announce another American military campaign, we're sitting down with H.D.S. David Greenway. His new memoir is Foreign Correspondent. There are many wonderful stories in this memoir, and I want to come to more, but you've got a big thesis as well, and I think it still applies to the situation that President Obama will be confronting in his speech tonight. You look at the great unwinding of the colonial era age as really the arc of your long career in foreign news.
Yes, I came to the conclusion that the decolonialization process after World War II was really the big story of the times, and that America got distracted in its concentration on communism and preventing communism. And we sometimes were slow to see that much more important than communism to people around the world was this desire to run their own show and not have the French or the British telling them what to do. And I think that was one of the reasons we failed in Vietnam. We didn't understand that. And when we came into Iraq, I was very interested to read that Henry Kissinger, who was in favor of the Iraq War, is now saying that seeking to implement American values by military occupation in a part of the world where it had no historical roots proved beyond what the American people would support and what Iraqi society would accommodate. And I think the same is true in to a certain extent in Afghanistan, although the jury is still out. But we can't motivate Afghanis any more than we can motivate South Vietnamese or Iraqis. They have to do that themselves.
What does that mean for world order? That sounds a bit like President Obama's speech, famous speech at West Point, which expressed a lot of reluctance to get too deeply involved in other people's business. They've got to do it themselves was kind of his message, and he's taking a lot of heat for that right now, saying if America doesn't lead, if it's not out there, the world goes to chaos.
It's one thing to lead and another thing to rely on military force for the be-all and the end-all of your leadership. And I think that's we've been putting too much faith on a military solution. By all means, we can lead and bring a coalition together, but it's going to be the Iraqi Sunnis who are going to have to decide whether they want ISIS or not. And I'm sure they will decide not, and we can give them help. But I saw the South Vietnamese army fall apart much better equipped than the North Vietnamese Army.
At the Vietnam War, after the Americans had withdrawn,
yes,
it was theirs.
But here they were much better armed than the North Vietnamese, far more firepower, but they lacked the motivation. They didn't know what they were fighting for, and the other side did. And so they just dissolved, very much like the Iraqi army dissolved this summer when ISIS hit them. And only the indigenous people themselves can motivate. This is not something a foreign power can do.
Is the situation that the United States, President Obama, faces in Iraq and Syria with the Islamic State, is it still part? Does it fit into your thesis of the unwinding of the colonial era even now? Or are we on some new field?
Well, nothing's exactly the same. I mean, Iraq has been – but they were occupied by us and there's still a lot of resentment. And when you look back, all the chaos that caused is the breeding ground for Islamic extremism. They thrive in a chaotic situation like a petri dish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that chaos that is the breeding ground for all the trouble. And I would just hope that Obama is a very tough decision. I'm not saying do nothing, but I'd be very alarmed if we go too far into this and begin to take it over. And then the Iraqis themselves, who are the only final solution, won't be handling it.
And yet we've seen again and again. We send advisors. You saw it in Vietnam. We saw where that went. H.D.S. Greenway is with us. His new memoir covers nearly 50 years of reporting around the world. An elegant and deeply insightful book is with us in the studio. David, lots of callers for you. Let me go to Harvey in Key West, Florida. Harvey, you're on the air with H.D.S. Greenway.
Thank you. Mr. Greenway, you're completely on point. No one has mentioned in America that Foley and Sattler were taking unnecessary risks because that's what their personalities were. Foley had been captured months before and was released, and that people begged him not to go back. Now, and Sattler obviously knew that he couldn't hide that he was Jewish, and so they were moving unwisely and taking unnecessary risks. Now, we are playing into the hands of the terrorists who are showing something horrific and understanding that America will overreact, and that's exactly the cat and the mouse trap that we're going to jump into. The beheading is, after all, just a method of killing. You can be killed by being shot or poisoned, and they knew cutting off someone's head is particularly horrific for Western people not used to such things. So we're being led by the nose by individual terrorists to get our goat and then responding unwisely, which will only lead to if, and we say we do not save hostages by paying ransom, and they say if you continue the drones or this or that, this one will die, that one will die. And instead of in private, behind-the-scenes negotiations.
Harvey, we've got it. Too much risk taken by these reporters, you say. A direct provocation of the United States, we can all see. We heard some of that. Here's a little bit of that tape after Stephen Sotloff. This was delivered along with word that he had died.
I'm back, Obama, and I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State, because of your insistence in continuing your bombings in Amr al-Zumar and the Mosul Dam, despite our serious warnings. You, Obama, have yet again, through your actions, killed yet another American citizen. So just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people.
The Islamic State video that came out along with Sotloff's harrowing beheading and death. David, a couple of pieces to our callers' observations. Number one, unnecessary risk. That's a fraught observation for journalists. Some risk comes with this territory.
Well, I think that's a very good point, although I agree with the caller about the motive of the terrorists being partly to cause an overreaction. I must stand up for these guys because it's a dangerous profession. And if you're going to have reporters in the field, you can try to hedge your bets and take some precautions. But at the end of the day, it's a dangerous business, and people are going to get caught and killed. I wouldn't want to blame them for taking unnecessary risks.
Give us some perspective on that. Take us back to Vietnam and the kind of risks you and others took, just to be fair to these
yes.
these guys who were in a new arena.
Well, I considered myself extremely risk averse, but I got shot in Vietnam. It, you know, it just happens. And
You were in the Tet Offensive in
yes.
way. I mean, even at yes. points, having you pulled an American soldier out of harm's way, got a Bronze Star for that, by the way. Somewhat controversial in journalistic circles to do that, but there you were. The gunfire was flying, and you were getting the story.
But that's the point. These two fellows were trying to get the story, and that's always going to be dangerous and always going to be risky. And so I wouldn't assign blame to them, but I certainly would assign some caution of overreaction.
The provocation. Do you think we'll bite? Will the president bite tonight?
I don't know, but I certainly hope he doesn't.
What would constitute a bite?
Well, I suppose to go in too deep and get committed. I don't think he's going to do that. He says, I'm not going to put in ground troops. But you know how these things build up. You begin to air power, and that doesn't work very well, you find, or it isn't going fast enough, and you try something else, try special forces. I mean, you know, these things can build up. And all I'm saying is that we're not going to be able to defeat ISIS ourselves. This is what the Arabs are going to have to do in both Syria and in Iraq. And ultimately, we can help them, but we can't do it on our own.
It's a fine line and easily crossed. Sean in Nashville, Tennessee. Sean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. First, I just want to thank you and all of the people in your field who do such great work to keep us informed. We couldn't live in a world without you and understand where we were, so thank you. My question is, how, given the risks associated with reporting, do you make a decision to go into a certain situation? And how do you decide not to? Specifically, it's as I grow up in this world, it becomes increasingly apparent that things aren't black and white, and there are spans and gray areas which are difficult to make decisions in. Are there tools that you use to decide this story is worth this risk? And if so, what are they?
Sean, let me take it to David Greenway. We know how hard this is. Sometimes you can't avoid it. I went into Somalia, three cars full of gunmen, mm-hmm. and yet it was the only way to get out of the UN encampment at the coast. Mm-hmm. You tell story after story of these decisions being made. Maybe take us back to Cambodia. There were tough decisions made there. You lost friends covering that story.
Well, every theater, every war, every situation has its own rules. And when you get to a place you don't know very well, it's good to talk to your colleagues and say, "Well, what are some of the risks you're taking here, and what gonna?" For example, in Cambodia, if you were driving down the road and you didn't see traffic coming the other way, mm-hmm. you stopped and turned around and went back to Phnom Penh, because it meant that there was a roadblock, and most probably the roadblock was going to be somebody you didn't want to meet. If you went into a village, and children in Cambodia, indeed children everywhere, are very curious, and they would crowd around a foreigner. And if the children didn't crowd around you, it meant that they or their parents were frightened, and it kept them inside. Mm-hmm. The parents weren't going to tell you what was going on.
If the kids don't come out, time to get out.
Exactly. If the kids don't come out, time to get out. So every theater, I'm sure I haven't covered this war in Syria, but I'm sure that there are rules there too, sort of like that. But let me say that the Syrian conflict is especially dangerous because there's no one on our side. Mm-hmm. The Syrian government isn't on our side. The rebels are, maybe a few are on our side, but many are not. So there's no one to look after you. At least in Cambodia, the Cambodian army was on our side.
Shrinking back in Phnom Penh, the capital, but nevertheless,
yes.
there was some anchor
yes.
there.
Yes, some anchor. And in Syria, there's no anchor. There's no nobody's going to, you don't know who's going to be on your side.
Is that a sign of America's changed status in the world? There are more sort of free fire zones today. Or is that about the end of the Cold War and the neat compartmentalization of the world?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with it. And the decolonization process is going on in the sense that the entities set up after World War I and World War II are beginning to crack. You mentioned Bangladesh. That was part of Pakistan, but it felt like a colony of a colony.
Mm-hmm.
So
and was looking to break away in the war there.
Yes, the same way that the Indian subcontinent began to splinter first there was the entity of Pakistan and India, then Bangladesh.
Left behind by the British when they departed.
Yeah, and given their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But then Bangladesh left Pakistan because it felt like a colony of a colony. And we see this happening in Iraq, that it's going back to the entity of Iraq that the British set up with Kurds and Sunnis and Shia is beginning to crumble. I don't think there's any going back for Kurdistan. I think that
it's going to be.
They're gone. I don't think
out of Iraq.
Yeah.
But you describe all the subtleties, all the intrigue in the players here. Mm-hmm. You were in East Pakistan as it wanted to become Bangladesh. You came back after that fighting. You had spotted those Indian weapons being carried by the would-be Bangladeshis. Turns out,
well, yes, I had memorized when I went to visit the Bangladeshi rebels. I wanted to find out how much India was helping them. And so I had memorized the Indian weapons as compared to the Pakistani weapons. And I saw some Indian weapons. So I asked the commander, where are you getting your weapons? He said, oh, no, they're all Pakistani weapons that we've captured. And I said, well, why are you carrying – some of your people have got some Indian weapons here. And he said, oh, please don't write that. Please don't write that. So years later, I run into the same commander.
An amazing story.
He's now a district commissioner up in Rangpur in the north of the country. And he said, oh, yes, I remember you. You were the reporter who caught me with those Indian weapons. And I said, yep, that was me. And he said, what you didn't realize is that those were Indian soldiers carrying them.
They weren't just providing weapons.
Yes.
HGS Greenway on the case, but the case is often a little more subtle than we can see.
Well, that's it. That reporters only – it's very rare you can get the whole story. And there's always another layer and another layer that we don't get or understand at the time.
But at least at that time, we had wave on wave of American reporters, international reporters, who would show up. Today, mm-hmm. not so clear that they'll even be there.
Well, that's a – to me, it's a terrific tragedy. And Tom, you remember yourself. You were our star in Asia, and now the Boston Globe doesn't have any reporters anymore.
Newspapers. Foreign reporters anywhere in the world,
no,
based abroad.
No, because so many local papers like ours in Boston don't can't afford that anymore.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound of gunfire recorded there by a South Vietnamese cameraman during the Battle of Hue in the Vietnam War, 1968. My guest today, HDS Greenway, was there covering Vietnam for Time magazine and then the Washington Post. He's out with a new memoir of nearly 50 years in the foreign news business in arenas, conflicts all over the world. You can join us this hour. How do you connect with foreign news today? Are we plugged in or checking out as journalists come home or are never sent in the first place? And what will you be listening for tonight in President Obama's big speech on America's role abroad? Here's the president on Sunday on Meet the Press talking about what this new effort will be and will not be.
This is not going to be an announcement about U.S. ground troops. This is not the equivalent of the Iraq War. What this is similar to the kinds of counterterrorism campaigns that we've been engaging in consistently over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
the president, who will have more to say tonight. David Greenway is with me in the studio, who's reported from 96 countries, covered conflicts in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Israel, Iraq, Vietnam, Cambodia, the former Yugoslavia. This is the perspective of a lot of time in the field. Nancy, in London, Connecticut, you're on the air with David Greenway. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Hi. I wanted to say the Syrian Free Army is known to be, which the U.S. supports, supposedly, in Syria, is known to behead people. Is the reason that we're going into another endless war for oil because two Americans were done that way? Well, the U.S. should stop spending the billions of dollars that it's spending on endless war for oil and start spending it on the 20 million children who go to bed hungry every night in this country, or the millions of seniors who go to bed hungry every night in this country. We must stop this endless war and support life in this country.
Nancy, I appreciate your call. David, I want to hear your perspective. Nancy's comment reminds me of a story you share in the book after the fall of the Berlin Wall. You sat down with a high Communist Party official in Poland. He said, we had it wrong. We did it wrong. We lost. You won. But you're at risk as well, America, if you don't take care of the fullness of your people.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I appreciate the caller's sentiments. But I'd also say that we are in a leadership position, and it's important for us to maintain that. As I said, I don't think that should be done by invading Muslim countries. But we do have some responsibilities, and it's in our interests to protect them. So
you hear how jaundiced our caller Nancy is on that front, though. Endless war for oil is what she sees.
Yes, but I think there's a little more at stake than oil here. I don't envy the president his position. And one thing we haven't talked about, consider the irony. What the president is planning to do is go after the Syrian regime, which we supposedly don't like, and Bashar must go, said the president. And yet we are now going to take out his biggest opponent and the most threatening opponent. So there's some...
In effect, very possibly supporting him keenly, if not enthusiastically, if not deliberately.
This is the problem with getting involved in other people's civil wars.
Roger in Oklahoma City. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wish you were there in the studio because I would give Dave a great big hug. I was in Vietnam for two tours as a helicopter pilot. I've been a student of international affairs ever since, and my life has taught me exactly the same lessons that he's learned from a different point of view. My point is this. We are constantly doing the wrong thing. We're being provoked, and we're taking the easy way out, and the easy way out is fighting. We're a big country. We're a wealthy country. Why can't we flood that area with Arab speakers, with spies, with agents? Why don't we have people on the ground who can do assassinations? Take the example of Byzantium, which started as the Eastern Roman Empire. They struggled on for centuries using agents provocateurs and spies and black propaganda and bribery and yada, yada. There's so many things we could do. We could have bought Afghanistan at fair market price for half of what we paid in that war. I think my point's clear. I'll shut up.
Roger, thank you for calling. Two tours in Vietnam and saying now all these years later, anything, please. And you can see he's pretty open-minded about what that might mean. Anything, please, but the machinery of war.
Yes. Well, I wonder if I rode in your helicopter at some time. But anyway, to your point, I think that going back to what I said before, that leadership can take many forms. And maybe the military aspect we have overplayed. But I could see – I hope that some of the things you suggest are being considered now. We certainly can work with the other Arab countries and point out to them that whatever the differences they have themselves, that defeating ISIS is a good idea. We might even try – it's in Iran's interest – to curb ISIS. So I hope that we're talking to Iran quietly about this, as well as the Saudis and the Gulf states. So there are many other ways to form an alliance rather than sending in troops, which I think Obama has no intention of doing.
Though clearly there will be a military face to this.
Yes, there will.
John in St. Simons Island, Georgia. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, David. Do you think that it's inherent in the military that military creep, mission creep occurs? I'm a Vietnam veteran. It's always seemed to me that, on some level or other, it's at the military's best interest to become involved in a war, and therefore we've got to be real, real careful about mission creep. And I wanted to get your reaction to that statement, number one. And number two, my comment is this. I almost feel sorry for guys like Bill Clinton and George Bush Jr. for having missed the war. It was the defining event of our generation, and they chose to miss it. And I've evolved to the point where I almost feel sorry for these guys for having missed the show that it was. But anyway, appreciate it. And
thank you, John.
Answer my question if you've got it.
David,
got
mission creep in the military.
Yeah. Well, the military does what the politicians tell it to do, and it does a pretty good job of it. It's in the nature of militaries to say this is our task and this we're going to perform it. Sometimes I think that certainly in Vietnam, that the amount of wishful thinking crept in, where headquarters were thinking wishfully that things should go better, and therefore they kind of came to the conclusion that they were winning when they weren't winning. So I think that's a danger, wishful thinking. But mission creep is just as the fault of the politicians who get involved. I wouldn't blame the military for that because at least in our country, the military does what the elected leaders tell them to do.
Though you do write how in Vietnam, and I've thought of this often, how you're kind of sneaking suspicion that Vietnam itself as a country, the Vietnamese as a people, were so beguiling, sometimes alluring, that it may have invited the United States military to stay longer than it would have otherwise. You can't think that we wouldn't be happy to be out of the deserts of Iraq, but Vietnam had an unbelievable charm.
Well, it had it did have a charm, but I don't think that any person in the military would like to be in Vietnam as a soldier. I mean, that was pretty tough. So I wouldn't think that the military was beguiled by the Vietnamese culture. I might have been, but soldiers who were there and soldiers, Vietnam vets who are listening to me, I think would agree that that wasn't exactly where you wanted to be.
Though there were some warm arms that could offer some comfort. John in Austin, Texas. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of a general observation and a question really for you guys, both of you. It is very common, in fact, inevitable, that the media refers to the United States as we. We do this, we do that, we invade Iraq, we made choices in Vietnam. The plain fact of the matter is that it was not us. We are the people of the United States did not choose to do these things. A handful of individuals at the political, governmental elite made choices on our behalf that forced the rest of us basically to go along with it, some enthusiastically, some violently resisting. But the media's continual use of the word we tends to deflect the accountability and responsibility of those people who actually made these bad decisions.
John, it's a strong and interesting point, and let us pick it up right here. Our time begins to grow short. You know, David, it's very interesting. As a longtime news reporter myself, as you were for many years, in news reporting, we is not a word I ever would have used.
That's right.
I have found in a conversation like this, a talk show, to my mind, in a democracy, this is one of the places where we, as Americans and others, come to talk these things through. So the we shows up in this forum. But what about John's point that He's not even buying the kind of democratic power and leverage of the American people. We have a policies shaped and driven by elites. You hear the disillusionment.
Well, I can sympathize with that, but I guess I'm using the word we now because I'm an American. Yes, I'm a reporter, and as Tom said, I didn't use we in my copy as a reporter, but in a conversation now, I'm an American, and
looking back on a long career and its large emanations.
And at the end of the day, I belong to this country. But I would hope, and I still have faith in American democracy, that we may choose the wrong people from time to time, but we are a democracy and votes count. And if we don't like the leaders and their decision, we can vote them out. So, we are not living in a place where the people have no say.
John, there's a take heart message. I'm not sure if you will, but there it is. Let's go to Jim in Akron, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. One or two questions. I'd like to ask your guest how he thinks the financial problems of the newspaper industry has affected the journalists themselves, if it's increased the number of these freelance journalists, and also to compare and contrast these freelancers who have been executed with the type of journalism that occurred during the Bush administration when journalists were widely criticized for being so limp-wristed that all they did was report what they were told, to toe the line that the Bush administration wanted to put out. It's a really dramatic change in the direction of these journalists.
There was a lot of that criticism after the entrance into the Iraq War, a lot of self-criticism as well after Colin Powell's presentation and all the rest. David, what about the independence of American journalists and simply the volume, depth, quality of what we're learning about the world in an era where resources have been so reduced?
Well, I think that's the bottom line is the bottom line. And as the inability to pay for reporters to go to these places and have bureaus, there's no substitute for living in a place. It's all very well just to drop in and out. But if you have correspondents who are living in the place, then in their downtime, they're absorbing information and culture and everything that goes into what makes a foreign people think and operate. So I think
But we don't have that.
Oh, well, that's
the bureaus, of many papers and television networks. Yeah. They're closed, closed, closed.
And I think this is hurting the news. Without an informed public, mm-hmm. we can't make the decisions that a democracy, people in a democratic country have to make.
Do all the new digital media somehow compensate for that? You can go online and read all kinds of stuff from all over now.
Well, it's not as yet. Too much of it is not carefully edited and too much opinion sneaks in. With the good old tough editor who said, come on, this is your opinion. Now let's just the mm-hmm. facts. Mm-hmm. He's a vanishing breed, and I think that's too bad.
Sarah writes to us on Facebook, to you, David.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep from thinking of all humanity as a mess, given what you've seen?
Well, it certainly has its messy side, but I think you have to keep your optimism.
Is it intact after all these years in so many arenas?
Yes, I think so.
And with America's changed status in the world, does that look like a this is the end dynamic to you, or we'll muddle through, figure it out, be all right?
Well, as I said earlier, I don't believe in the decline of American power. I just think relatively we're not where we were when I started out, when we were unchallenged in riches and a devastated world was still recovering from World War II. So it's inevitable as countries recover, which we encouraged and to our benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things you can say for the United States.
I ran into your friends all over Asia there, Dennis Gray, saying you'd always sit on your helmet in the helicopter, or Jim Sterba filing ahead of me in Delhi when Indira Gandhi had been assassinated. The telephone call from you that night, many years ago now, in Singapore, to let me know that I would be the Boston Globe's bureau chief in Asia, one of the most exciting moments of my life. I'm grateful for it, David.
Well, don't forget the time when you were in Cambodia and you wanted to go somewhere and the officials weren't going to allow you to go. And you said, well, my boss is going to fire me if you don't let me go.
He's a taskmaster. Yeah, he's brutal.
Yes. So when I got there.
Some years later,
this minister of information looked at me and said, you so cruel to Ashbrook. You so cruel to Ashbrook.
Oh, good times and great memories amid some very tough stories, very well reported. My guest has been H.D.S. Greenway. His memoir is Foreign Correspondent. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Greenway, to you for all the reporting, all the stories, all the good companionship over so many years. My thanks, our thanks. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.